it is a great pleasure to introduce my friend from so many years and colleague Saskia Sassen, whom I've known since we've known each other from the beginning of our careers.
Kindergarten.
Whose trajectory has been really spectacular, from Notre Dame University to become really one of the major public intellectuals to come out of the field of sociology, not only in the United States, but worldwide, as her many recognitions throughout the U.S., Europe, and other countries attest. She is now the Robert S. Lynn Professor of Sociology and member of the Committee on Global Thought at Columbia University, that she rejoined after spending 8 years at the University of Chicago. Her famous book, The Global City, has been translated, as of last count, I hear, in 19 languages, and continues to be a standard reference for those interested in the field of urbanization, world system development, and the like. And she has not stopped there. I was talking to her that before we started the event, that perhaps it's time to stop, but she really has no intention to doing so and is carrying on with the same vigor and intellectual acumen as characterizes her work. Her new books are Territory, Authority, and Rights, From Medieval to Global Assemblages, published by Princeton University Press, and A Sociology of Globalization, published by Norton. And she has just completed for UNESCO a 5-year project on sustainable human settlement with a network of researchers and activists in no less in 30 countries, which is really a remarkable feat. So I don't need to extend this. We all know who Saskia Sassen is. This is simply to remind you, in case of her many achievements. And please join me in welcoming Professor Sassen.
So I'll be happy to take questions.
Would you like someone to moderate, or do you?
Oh, I can do this.
Okay.
Yes. So
it's going to take us a moment.
Yes. I know. It's a lot of stuff. Right. You can ask little questions too, okay? You don't have to give a question that sort of seeks to be the equal, let's say, to the little complex thing that I just gave you. Yes?
So I've got two questions. I can't claim that they're small ones. Okay. I'll ask them in the reverse order of significance. I was struck by the argument that we're losing rights, and I was also struck that all your examples are American. And I wonder, well, first of all, I wonder how one can count the rights that we are gaining, which are created all the time in different
right,
ways.
Right, yes.
And set them against the rights.
That's a good
that
question. Right.
And studying the European Union, which is a place where transnational rights are being created
right.
all the time, whether in the formal law, or again through court decisions, how you would set that
yes.
That's the first
right.
question. The second question is, one way to take the significance of your critique of the concepts of the opposition between the global and the national, and pointing to the very few examples of global law in the sense of law which has direct effects for individuals.
Or formalized, in the sense right. of formal.
Yeah, but, yeah. I mean, that individuals can invoke themselves as opposed to passing through states, would be to say that most of the action in terms of governance and regulation is what we would call transnational and supranational, so that the polarities are not the interesting thing. So that would suggest that, you know, one would then want an analysis of the emergent forms of transnational and supranational and multi-level governance and regulation. I'm not sure that I'm just restating your thesis in a different way, or whether that's actually different.
I see what you're saying. So let me answer. I'll take your questions after. But so on the first one, it is in a way easier to make the argument looking at the European Union. The European Union is a fairly formalized case where you have a mix of national and non-national elements. And non-national elements that really are active formalizing elements are both subnational, you know, the important, the subsidiarity rules, and they are, of course, European level, transnational. So to me, when I am in Europe, I would be much more likely to problematize the European Union, if you want. But here it seems almost like the European Union is that next phase that I'm talking about. You know, it represents a more advanced stage of this disassembling of certain master categories, in this case the unit on the national, and the reassembling, which in the European Union happens both at the subnational and at this transnational level. So that's one thing. So for me, the European Union is in fact a format of the future. It does not represent the future format for all parts of the world. It took enormous particularity. But it is one of the forms of the future. Whereas I think that a country like the United States, not, you know that Texas now wants to secede, you know that, right? That might also be part of it. But this is a very peculiar format we have in this country, you know? And I see in the future a kind of disassembly. But that, again, those people, you know, some people think that I say that the state is going away. No, I'm not. I think the denationalizing of the state, etc. But in that sense, for me, the European Union represents a next stage that illustrates some of the conditionalities that I sort of bring to bear on my analysis, right? This reassembling of the direct representation that subnationals can have at that transnational level. Now, the question of the government, there's much more to be said. And in the case, there are rights that are gained, but there are also, and to me, see, I would say, some of the rights that are gained, they still need to be made. I really am, something that I didn't talk about very much, I'm really at this stage, given this type of analysis, really emphasizing the need to make it. Making the political is a very abstract way of putting it, but also making citizenship. You know, and that is why I care about citizens launching global jurisdictions using national law. To me, that is also a making of the citizen, you know, a making of the powers that the citizen has. So in the case of Europe, for instance, we all know that EU citizenship is still very weak, but it's also very powerful, you know, in some ways. But there is a lot of making that needs to happen. And so when I talk about the European Union, I talk both about this question of format that I just talked about, but I also talk about the fact of all the work, you know, I become a critic, inevitably when you do it. So I say, there's a lot of making that needs to happen. And then the other disjunction is, of course, the speech acts of sovereigns. My God, if you just heard Sarkozy speak, you would think that he still has all the power, and in fact, all kinds of competences have shifted to the higher level. So there is a disjunction between the representational moment and what is actually happening. And then there is this fact that some of these changes that benefit citizens, I think, still have to be materialized in a way. Now, on the question of governance and all of that, I didn't really talk about governance at all. And yes, I used a lot of American examples. Not all of them, but a lot of them. Partly because we're here. Because, you know, if I start talking about some obscure things that I know about, that are happening, you know, in the United Arab Emirates, chances are it would be more difficult, it would take me more time. But it also must be said that the neoliberal story, which after all is part of the background of what I thought, is a very American story. You know, America is one of the extreme, not the most extreme perhaps, but it is one of the extreme cases where it becomes very legible. Though if I were writing, I would immediately have a footnote which would say that it is a mistake to just group it under neoliberalism, because a lot of this precedes neoliberalism. And so, but I'm giving you a very short answer. I hope that it gives some satisfaction. We are gaining rights, final point in your question, and certainly the gay rights movement, you know, there are all of the sort of the racialized, the discriminated, the minoritized citizen is engaging in struggles that are reaping some benefits, no doubt about it. The human rights issue is a different one. We have not incorporated that into our national law, but I don't know, people know the work of Harold Coe, a brilliant legal scholar who is the dean of the Yale Law School, who speaks, to me this is an extremely interesting process, and a lot of this is also happening, which he talks about a transnational process whereby the norms of the human rights regime enter the level of interpretation, you know, when judges make decisions, but not adjudication. But, he argues, eventually they become stabilized meanings. And then they can also become federalized, become national law, but dressed in different clothing. In other words, they're dressed like U.S. law, rather than human rights law, rather than what the Brits did, which is in 201, they literally incorporated the human rights regime. You as a citizen can go and use the international regime to make a lawsuit. We cannot do that. We have to go to some other instance for that. But what he describes is a very interesting process. Now, I think that also happened with the neoliberal transnational process. It does not just happen with the good things, the good guys, but also, you know. So there is that. That is another dimension that I didn't even touch. I mean, I signaled it. When my denationalizing is a bit of that transnational. He and I, in fact, he invited me to a public conversation because he decided that his transnational process was a bit like my denationalized process. It was very, very nice, but he's a lawyer, you know. Now, yes, let me take two questions in the back. I saw two hands up there. Yes.
We speak of this diminishing power of the nation state, and simultaneously this blurring of the line between the national, the global, and perhaps the subnational. So then I guess my question is, how do we begin to be, I guess, more as citizens
of the world?
Perhaps.
Citizens of what?
More citizens of the South and the developing world, which would be more my interest. How do, I guess also they, how do they begin to constitute citizenship? Or where do they locate their citizenship?
Right.
Simultaneously, they can't quite access the global. That's perhaps out of reach. Their national is still somewhat obscure. Perhaps they haven't even maintained or obtained an actual citizenship in the national sphere.
Right.
And, you know, you see in some states, you see a turning back to the subnational. So how do they or we or whomever it is start to articulate that citizenship?
Well, you know, it is not true that the global South has been less available, if you want, or the citizens of the global South, to try this other version, these other platforms. In fact, they have been far more active, like the indigenous people in Brazil, you know, to gain direct representation in international fora. The Sem Terra, you know, the Sem Terra, which is now a global movement, there is a kind of activism there. It's very interesting. Now, you know, part of how I would frame the issue, that also holds for some of the stuff that I talk about for the U.S., is that I take the variable powerlessness, and I take the concept of powerlessness, and I open it up into a variable. And I say, look, at one end, powerlessness is elementary. But at this end, it's complex. This end is not empowerment, okay? That is sort of a pragmatic American disposition, which I sort of like, that if there is any change in your powerlessness, it's got to mean that you're empowered. Well, not necessarily. I want to recover a range of meanings for the condition of powerlessness. Right? So, what I find in the global South is a much greater likelihood that powerlessness is complex. And partly that is the case, in Brazil is what I am especially thinking. Partly that is because there is very strong civil society organization. Partly because it's a need for survival in many, many cases. So the Sem Terra, a good example, they are very mobilized. They are really mobilized. They have not become empowered. But their powerlessness is complex. And then in my sort of interpretive move, you know, I'm doing it, that when powerlessness becomes complex, there is a possibility for the political. And by that I mean also making. And let me give you an example. Now, going back to the U.S. so as to make it clearer. when the discussions were going on in Congress about criminalizing illegality, illegal residents, undocumented, which, you know, criminalizing, that's a serious escalation. It means that, you know, if it's criminal, they're going to jail. There might be due process in between. But right now, it is not that. Now, you remember, 500,000 went on the streets in Los Angeles, 500,000 in
Chicago,
you know, etc. People carrying signs, I have the right to have rights, etc. And they were not touched, even as Congress was debating criminalizing. It's a very interesting juxtaposition. Now, the same person, let's say me, in that multitude on the streets of a big city, you know, I don't gain power, but something, my powerlessness becomes complex. But that same person on a farm in California, standing there by herself, I have the right to have rights. My employer or the labor contractor, whatever, is like, come on, back to work, or call the IRS. My powerlessness is elementary, and there again, back to spaces, you know, it doesn't just depend on the person, it's not your intrinsic whatevers. It is also the zone. So I think that, for whatever reasons, I think there are multiple civil society infrastructures in a lot of the global south. You know, and Latin America, Brazil is very significant. I think that Chavez's rise, Enzo Morales' rise, you know, all of those, that is partly linked to these platforms. We don't even see them. We, through our Western eye, don't see them. We who incorporate as NGOs, we who, you know, that's formalizing the machine, but that is there. And so in that sense, what I see in the global south is a kind of a powerlessness that is evincing complexity. Now, for me, in that complexity lies a possibility of making. It could be, though, a project, a trajectory that can take many generations. In these new constitutions, it is the powerless who are in a complex situation that lie behind the most radical element, the element that is an element of format for the future. I'm sure of that clause. That we will not accept that our national government are our exclusive representatives in international fora. We will not accept that. I think we're moving in that direction, right? So it is the indigenous people in Brazil. It is the African, black Africans in South Africa. They were critical actors in the shaping. So in that sense, again, you see, this is a condition of powerlessness that is complex. But I always say that about human rights regime. Did I just say that here already or not? The human rights regime is still, you know, a weak regime. But you know what? It has grown. And we now know it's not going away. Even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there's a notion that, God, it just would stay. Now we know it is here to stay. It is growing. It's expanding. It's not very strong. Now, how did that happen? Partly on the backs of very powerful people. Most of the cases in courts, in human rights courts, concern immigrants, asylum seekers, refugees, and women who have suffered genital mutilation. Genital cutting is now the proper term. Right? So, those people, when they become subjects of adjudications in a human rights court, they don't become empowered. Really not. Not if we want to give some, you know, content to empowerment. But you know what? What becomes evident is that their powerlessness is complex. They have made history. They collectively are making this human rights regime. So that is a way, and again, it means that you have to be a bit less pragmatic than saying, look, all of this only counts, which is a very sober position, if then you get empowered. Otherwise, what the, you know, it just works. You know, you have to be available for that zone where I'm placing myself, right? That it is sort of works. So do I answer your question or no? So I would reposition the global south situation in this more complex landscape. They are making history, but it can take generations. And empowerment is not necessarily the indicator that something has happened. Yes?
Yeah, I have two questions, quick ones. One is, the categories now that you're trying to juxtapose, national and globalization, and you refuse to juxtapose, and I agree with you, I mean, they are problematic. However, they are both positive. By positive, that they are constituting subjects, right? Nationalism tries to actually.
Yes, that's a very good point. Yes.
And you choose to be a deconstructionist poem, which is limited to national. So in a way, you're trying to create an assemblage that is national and global at the same time. And that probably national, you know, the state is trying, is incorporating globalization within its framework. And it's kind of an instrument of globalization. And I agree with you in so many ways. But at the same time, you try to deconstruct the nationalism. So by saying denationalization, first it's a negative category rather than positive. So it doesn't tell us what kind of subjectivities it's creating.
That's correct. It's a very neutral, uncommittal.
Right.
Yes.
Or not even neutral, it's actually negative. It's
okay, negative.
It takes away from subjectivities. It empties nationalism from its power. That's one. So if you can play out with these categories of national and global, I'd like to hear what you say. But then the other thing, and it's a quick one, which follows on this question on the South. And I think that, I mean, well, and I think I talked to you a little bit about it on lunch, during lunch, where assemblages reframe relations of power in certain ways. And that's what I'm interested in. What kind of relations of power these assemblages, new local global assemblages, are reframing? What is it that they are doing? So,
Okay, now on the first one, I use denationalization as a minimalist designation. Because I also say it's multivalent. You know, some of the stuff I really like is getting denied, but some of it I don't. You know, I find it very problematic. So for me, there's a lot of multivalence. Same thing I'm going to say with the global and the national. If you read the full text, you will see that I think that the global as well as the national, in their various, you know, the various constitutive elements, there is multivalence. And multivalence here comes from particular what is one's normative ground, what is, you know, this is all very charged stuff. But I just want to say they're not neutral, nor are they simply negative in the sense, or nor is denationalization negative in the sense that it is voided of marked content, marked in terms of the valence, good or bad, liberating or making for more power. So denationalization is in a way a different category than global and national. Global and national capture very complex worlds with a lot of multivalence. I like a lot of globality, and there's a lot of globality that I don't like at all, because I think it feeds more power, more inequality, all of that. Same thing with the national. Though I like a denationalized national. Where that leaves one, I don't know, but that's my fantasy, all right? I can't quite. Denationalization is an operational term for me. It's a way of marking a connection, a historic trajectory. There was the national. We made the national. Now, in many particular fragmentary, often not easily coded as denationalization, where all of that. So that is, and I hope, you know, as I said, you know, I grew up in five languages, and language is sort of a zone of experimentation. It's either a zone of terror, if you're in my situation. I don't speak one language well. That's a problem, you know, if you're a writer. But rather than being terrified by it, I experiment with it, you know. So denationalization is really an operational term. In a way that global city is, you know, which is a jarring term. Global, it's either city or global. When I first said that in the early 80s, people said, it doesn't work. Well, it actually worked very well. It captured attention, right? Denationalization is a more awkward term. And it has a negative, deep national, right? But I want that connection, that contradictory connection with the national, because I think we're still there. I think, frankly, I always say that, the big elephant in any global room, in any global discussion, is the national. You know, when people say, well, it's like returning to medieval times, no. Because in that period, we made the national, which in its best form is a regulatory state, perhaps a king state, whatever. So that will not work. Now, the power alignments, the power structures, absolutely. Now, I happen to think that not all power is bad. I think some powers are good. There are all kinds of new formations. Now, when I was talking in passing about the executive branch of government, it turns out the executive branch of government has become more powerful because of neoliberalism, which goes against so much that has been said. And what hangs in there are two things. One of them is that the category, the state, doesn't help us. The nation state, not a helpful priority. You know, so all of that, I don't want to go back there. The other thing that hangs in this rising power of the executive is that what we have seen is like a natural experiment. We couldn't do it in the laboratory. Just, of course, within social sciences are always handicapped. But this is like a natural experiment in the sense that it has shown us that the state, or really the executive branch, forever a very nationalist actor, as I was saying earlier, even when it needs a global empire to be in, you know, that then has evinced an incipient internationalism. The problem is that it isn't internationalism geared towards the making of a global corporate economy. For me, that is a bit of a problem. My question, I wrote a little piece in Dissent recently, I don't know if anybody, January, February was very, because you know we knew that Obama was in, etc. And so I wrote a little story where I listed all the ways in which the executive branch of government has gained power because of globalization, and how the executive branch of government, outside state of exception, is today more powerful than it has been since the New Deal. And so I ask at the end, how will our new president use all this power? So one possibility is, of course, that that incipient internationalism married with a president who has a much broader agenda than the global corporate economy can mean that a key component, not all, a key component of the national state apparatus can be re-geared towards other kinds of internationalism. Environment, global justice, it's a bit of a fantasy of mine, right? But again, if I thought about the format of the future, for me the format of the future is not that the states disappear, but that they become denationalized and internationalist. It is a fantasy, I know. But I like that, you see. So in that sense, the alignments of power, there are all kinds of alignments. There are power logics at work. Some of them are really unattractive, some of them are not. And this question that I was in my prior, you know, that certain kinds of powerlessness become complex when stabilized meanings become unstable. The powerless have terrain to play. I think I have a talk that I give now about religion and how the ascendance of religion in this period when some features of the secular state become unstable creates a blank for all kinds of, that was once the exclusive terrain, exclusive, that's the key here, not just any, of the secular state. The secular state has withdrawn from all kinds of neoliberal policies, privatization, whatever. And other actors enter in that terrain that was once exclusive to the national state. NGOs, also religion. And so then religion, no matter how old it is, no matter how regressive a particular content of a religion might be, religion then becomes part of this modernity that we're making. And I don't know that I didn't use it in this talk because I didn't want to bury you too much. But I use modernity really not as a freed category from the Enlightenment modernism and its didactic quality, right? So I think, you know, there are multiple modernities that coexist. What I'm trying to capture with my assemblage is one emergent modernity that I think is signaling a move to future formats, etc. In that modernity, religion, I think, is part of that modernity. It doesn't matter that it is an old religion. It doesn't matter it's anachronistic. And so that resituates religion in a way that you can deal with it different theoretically. Theoretically is not my thing. But anyhow, I don't know if I, because you ask excellent questions. There were some other questions. I can't remember. Yes.
So I'm not a sociologist.
That's okay.
Slightly different.
Neither am I really completely, so don't worry.
I was interested in your image of globalization or the global and the national being these bright lights that cast and can clarify these massive
the shadows.
That they cast certain shadows. And I was wondering also about the human and the light that it shines and the things that
you got
it
me there when you're talking with human. That's my
theoretically, no, because I'm thinking about certain court cases, like recently in Spain, the great apes gaining certain rights, and how this also how the sort of tension with human animal connection is part of these other assemblages potentially that are coming out and then speak globally, right? I mean, that has a sort of global appeal to all to animals per se, or to creatures per se.
Are you also thinking Snyder and that kind of work? Philosopher? Okay.
Carrie Wolf and...
No, but this has become a big issue. I mean, we have taken a first step, especially in sociology actually, by recognizing that networks, crucial category for sociology nowadays, that networks also, which are typically reduced to actors who have rational choice features, that part, some of the actors, a growing number of actors in networks, are machines that calculate. Calculation is different from rational choice. And so that then has unsettled the very classical notions of sociological networks, you know, including the more reified methodologically. And now we're dealing with this question. There are two other fronts where we have these fusions that then unsettle traditional binaries. That's one way of putting it. And one of them is, of course, the ecological, right? The whole category of rurality, department of rural system, but rurality is a very interesting category. Rurality is a profoundly unsettled category. And so how we, and it has to do with a whole bunch of things. Nature is an unsettled category. Now, the other thing is this question that is often isolated from these more complex conceptual terrains, you know, where you sort of bring in stuff that doesn't belong together. The animal rights people have done the opposite. They just say they breathe, they have rights. But there's a way that I want to recover, and there are some very interesting philosophers who are debating these issues now, is the equivalent of bringing in a machine that calculates rather than rational choices in a conceptual frame where before, you know, they were not present. And that and so on. And at that point, I'm just beginning to work around this because I'm interested in these spaces that are charged with contradictions, things that don't work together. You know, that is really what I'm dealing with. And so I don't have a full answer, but I know that it is an issue. Now, the ecological dimension, you know what that is, right? It forces us. So if I ask where comes the discipline, because that is one of the things we need to confront, where is the discipline that leads us to have to incorporate, rather than I sit back, I look at all these pretty things, I say, oh, let's throw them together. You know, that is also what you can do. But as a researcher on certain things, you know, what is it? And it is ecological. And we know that by destroying certain species, there are consequences that are going to hit us back in the earth. So the ecological and its multiscalar capacity, you know, so it looks like benign at X or negative at X level, turns out to be lethal. I don't know. So in that sense, the ecologists and their analytics are enormously powerful. I have now engaged with a whole bunch of these people at the Santa Fe Institute, you know, which is mostly physicists, who in order to escape physics, use biology. And to simplify it a bit, they use ecology. I have the most fun sort of engagements, you know, at the Santa Fe Institute, you know what I'm talking about, right? Chaos theory and all that. Anyhow, so that is then one way. You know, the ecological framing forces us to take account of what you're just describing. That is one disciplinary move that takes you in that direction, you know, with its own compelling logic rather than your own sort of desires and wishes. Is there one other question? Yes.
The question I have is, and I'd like to hear more about what constitutes the global jurisdiction in the case that would not be supranational. Because we talk about this, we talk about the
That's a very good question.
Then what authority in this global community in these spaces?
Okay.
What are you calling down as a global authority that is not supra or translocal or transnational?
Oh, there on global authority, there you left me. But what I thought you were asking is, I'm reframing slightly, okay? Are there today, in the making or already achieved, global jurisdictions that are not outside the national, nor do they belong to the supranational space, but are actually inside? And I do think that that's what WTO law does, and that is what the ICC does, and that is what some of these other more Zamizdat operations, like those lawsuits that I was, you know, where you use an old law, you go to law, and you make something like that. So this is at the heart of a lot of this stuff that I'm talking about, you know. And most of it is not formalized as a self-evident. So is Harold Pohl's notion of a transnational process. You know? It injects but this is often in the clothing of the national. This is one of the big issues for me. How much of this denationalized keeps on being dressed in the clothing of the national? So you actually, there's kind of a hermeneutic task that you need to engage in before you can get there. You know? Yes, thank you. That's a great question. All right, people, thank you very, very much for your attention.